Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The Jordanian ambassador has been abducted in Libya, and gunmen abduct 200 girls from a Nigerian school. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Gunmen have kidnapped the Jordanian ambassador in the Libyan capital of Tripoli. The Libyan foreign ministry officials say assailants in two cars opened fire on the convoy carrying the ambassador Fawaz al-Itan this morning as it traveled through the city center near the Jordanian embassy. His driver was wounded in that attack. Libya's foreign ministry spokesman said authorities are closely following the case and are working to ensure the safety of the ambassador. However, the motive behind the abduction is unclear. Gunmen have kidnapped an estimated 200 students from a school for girls in northeastern Nigeria. Witnesses say the mass abduction took place in the early hours this morning as gunmen attacked the town of Chibok in Borno State. A local resident tells VOA's Houses Service that the assailants burned houses, offices, and the government girls' secondary school before kidnapping the students, who he says were packed into a truck. The local police commissioner has confirmed the incident. However, there's been no claim of responsibility for either the attack or the kidnapping. Prosecutor Jerry Nell has finished his cross-examination of South African runner Oscar Pistorius by telling the court that Pistorius meant to shoot and kill his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp. Today's court session was the fifth day that Nell and Pistorius sparred over details of last year's killings as the prosecution sought to counter the athlete's defense that he thought he was shooting a nighttime intruder.
She locked herself into the toilet. You armed yourself for the sole purpose of shooting and killing her.
That's not true, my lady.
And that's what you did. Afterwards, indeed, you were overcome by what you've done. That is true.
That is true, my lady.
Only because it was your intention to kill her. You realized that.
On the opposite, my lady.
Meanwhile, the athlete's defense team is continuing to present its case to the court. A bomb has exploded in Egypt's capital, wounding two policemen. Officials say the blast today in central Cairo targeted a security checkpoint. Militants have carried out a series of bombings and shootings since the army ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi last July. 1 year after the deadly Boston Marathon bombings in northeast U.S. city today pays solemn tribute to the victims of the attack at one of the world's premier sporting event. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden joined state and local officials as well as bombing survivors at a ceremony at Boston's Heinz Convention Center. There will also be a flag-raising ceremony and a moment of silence at the race's finish line. Two pressure cooker devices, allegedly hidden in backpacks by two brothers of Chechen descent, 26-year-old Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his 20-year-old brother Johar, sent metal fragments through the crowd of bystanders. Several people lost limbs. Mark Forcarol lost his right leg from above the knee.
I woke up on the ground with the firefighter on me, putting a tourniquet on my leg.
He sustained other shrapnel wounds and could still lose his left leg. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
A robotic submarine is set to resume its search for the missing Malaysian jet in the Indian Ocean a day after aborting its first mission. The unmanned Bluefin 21 submarine was deployed Monday night to start what was supposed to be a 16-hour search of the seabed for the Malaysian Airlines MH370, but that mission was cut short after the submarine entered an area that exceeded its operating depth. The U.S. Navy officials say that built-in safety feature returned it to the surface and that it was not damaged. Officials say data collected from the sub's six-hour mission was analyzed and showed no signs of that missing plane. Iran is asking a U.N. committee to hold a special meeting on the refusal of the United States to issue a visa to Iran's choice for its ambassador to the U.N. American officials object to Iran's selection of Hamid Abdullahi because of his alleged involvement in the 1979 seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran. White House spokesman Jay Carney said last week that the choice is not viable. In a letter, Iran's mission to the UN said that the decision has negative implications diplomatically and creates a dangerous precedent. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening. It's 18 hours UTC and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
While attacks by the militant group Boko Haram have killed many people in northern Nigeria, communal violence is also taking a toll. The group, Human Rights Watch, says since December, more than 1,000 people have been killed in five northern states.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details next. Also in the news, gunmen today have kidnapped an estimated 200 students from a school for girls in northeastern Nigeria. And as fighting continues in South Sudan, the number of refugees pouring into neighboring Ethiopia continues to rise. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Guinea, and our daily feature. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, gunmen have kidnapped an estimated 200 students from a school for girls in northeastern Nigeria. Witnesses say the mass abduction took place in the early hours today as the gunmen attacked the town of Chibok in Borno State. A local resident tells VOA that the assailants burned houses, offices, and the Chibok government girls' secondary school before kidnapping the students, who he says were packed into a truck. The local police commissioner confirmed the incident. There has been no claim of responsibility for the attack or the kidnapping. The attack is similar to others carried out by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. It's blamed for the scores of attacks on schools, markets, churches, mosques, and other targets since 2009. Borno is one of three states under a state of emergency since last May. Nigeria's military has launched operations meant to crush the militant group, but large-scale attacks have continued. And in the aftermath of the worst terrorist attack on the Nigerian capital yesterday since an insurgency began in 2009, those who have escaped with their lives but lost everything else. Officials say they are looking at ways to help the bombing victims and boosting security ahead of the World Economic Forum for Africa to be held in Nigeria next month. Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from Abuja.
At this Abuja hospital, some bomb blast victims moan softly, but most sleep. They've lost limbs and been burnt. Vere Ivbezim, a fruit seller, had her jaw nearly knocked off by the blast that hit Monday as she was boarding a bus, killing 71 people and injuring at least 124 others. But she says it's not just lives that were lost.
All my money, all my hands, everything, I know who anything, only my life, I hope. I thank God for that. May government help us.
Outside the hospital, Benny Lahr, the chair of the Committee on Human Rights in the National Assembly, says many victims of the bombing were working-class people, barely scraping by in Abuja's satellite towns. The satellite towns are where civil servants and other employees of Nigeria's pristine capital live because they can't afford to stay in the city. The towns are notorious for lacking electricity, clean water, and for bad roads. Lahr says the government should find a way to help the blast victims recover economically.
Those that have lost their breadwinners or their families, they would definitely need some relief and some economic reintegration to the families of the victims.
Emergency management officials say they will be paying the hospital bills, but they have not determined if there will be any other form of compensation. The Director General of Abuja's FCT Emergency Management Agency, Abbas Idris, says the government is working to coordinate hospital response to mitigate the suffering of any future attacks. But Monday's attack, the first in 2 years in the capital, was so devastating that authorities don't have enough room for the bodies.
The situation is that it's not really accommodating the victims, so that is why we have to look for alternative places to relocate all the corpses.
Idris also says the local government is increasing security ahead of the World Economic Forum for Africa next month. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but analysts blame Boko Haram, an Islamist militant group that has killed thousands of people, saying it wants to enforce its harsh version of Islamic law. Most of the violence has been in the Northeast, where three states have been under emergency rule for nearly a year. Nigeria's military says it has largely contained the group, reclaiming formerly occupied lands, arresting and killing insurgents, and scattering many who escaped. But large-scale deadly attacks continue, and rights groups say more than 1,500 people have been killed this year alone. And at the Nyanya Motor Park, hours after the attack, Vera Achoen, a local English teacher, points to dozens of bombed-out city buses and says she fears the conflict is spreading.
Many died. Many. All those buses you see there, people were all filled inside to go, and then they had not yet gone. The drivers, the ones that survived, you see them swimming in blood.
The Nigerian Security and Civil Defense Corps says it will deploy 100,000 extra security guards on the roads and around churches for the upcoming Easter holiday. Boko Haram has threatened Christians and previously attacked churches on Christian holidays. However, the vast majority of its victims have been Muslims. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
While attacks by the militant group Boko Haram have killed many people in northern Nigeria, communal violence is also taking a toll. The group Human Rights Watch says since December, more than 1,000 people have been killed in five northern states. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
Human Rights Watch researcher Mausi Shegun says communal violence is a common occurrence.
The violence has been almost on a daily basis in some places, like Benue State, and in a few other places, you've had it almost on a weekly basis.
Speaking from the capital, Abuja, Shegun says communal violence has gone on for years in northern Nigeria, but she warns it's now spreading.
A lot of it we have been able to trace to tensions between the pastoralist herdsmen who are nomadic and farmers who find that their farmland and their crops are being destroyed by the cattle of the herdsmen. And then you'll have the herdsmen on the other hand also complaining about killing of the cattle, which is really a prized treasure to them.
Shegun says violence begets violence in northern Nigeria.
There might be revenge killing very soon because we can sense the frustrations of the people that there is no justice, there is no accountability for any of these attacks. These are very vicious crimes that have taken place. People have lost their family members, their limbs and property.
Human Rights Watch agrees there is little government follow-up.
Not in any of these attacks has there been any open or comprehensive investigations of those responsible for the attacks. We have spoken to scores of people who have been victims of these attacks, and the recurring story is that no one from the security agencies, neither from the police nor from the military, has been to take notes and to hear from them what they saw.
She says there may be a link between some of the communal violence and the militant group Boko Haram.
Some of the victims that we've spoken to have talked about same individuals who they claim may not be the same herdsmen that they are used to in their environment. They seem to be foreign to them. And so there seems to be some mercenary work going on as well. But there isn't really much to be said on the part of the government to take steps to put in all of this in check.
A few weeks ago, the Nigerian military announced that forces had been deployed to some of the areas hardest hit by the violence, particularly Benue, Nasarawa, and Plateau states.
Unfortunately, a couple of days after that, there was an attack which had been blamed on security forces in Kiana town against a Fulani community in which at least 30 people are said to have died. I've spoken to victims of that attack, and they confirm that these are military authorities. The authorities have said they are investigating that attack.
Human Rights Watch makes a number of recommendations to quell the communal violence in northern Nigeria. These include establishing clear boundaries for cattle routes and grazing areas, setting up mediation between farmers and herders on recognizing each other's rights, and ensuring that those believed responsible for mass killings are promptly investigated by specially trained police and then prosecuted. The group says the lack of justice for years of violence has created a combustible situation. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
As fighting continues in South Sudan, the number of refugees pouring into neighboring Ethiopia continues to rise. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports more than 95,000 South Sudanese have crossed the border since fighting broke out in December. It says more help is needed from the international community to meet the needs of the refugees. Spokesperson Ariane Ramri tells reporter Nabil Biagio that the majority of the South Sudanese refugees arriving in Ethiopia are women and children. She says they are forced to travel by foot for a long distance to flee conflict and hunger.
Some of them have walked as long as 25 days, so they're extremely tired. There's very high levels of malnutrition. They're not just fleeing the conflict, and many times they're fleeing the crisis as well. So by the time they get to Ethiopia, they're really in a very bad state. The levels of malnutrition are still very high. We've already had some 4,000 children, for example, entered into our nutrition programs once in the camps, and another 3,500 of lactating women. And of course, people are very tired and suffer from other sorts of illnesses as well because of the lack of care from the long trek to safety.
Your report says the number of South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia has passed the 95,000 mark. What does that mark represent?
What it represents is an ongoing crisis, and a crisis which is still not getting the support from the world. Also, what it represents is a steady stream of people as the rainy season approaches, which that means that we need to do more to improve the conditions for people. Already, as the rainy season looms, there have been wet conditions in some of the camps, and UNHCR and its partners have been working very hard in recent days to relocate people to higher ground, also to identify and to set up new camps, because we understand that this crisis is not over yet. People are still coming, and they need drier and better places to stay as the rains approach.
Your report also says some refugee camps have being affected by flood. So what preventive measures are you taking to address this problem during this rainy season?
The key thing that we're doing is that we're moving people to higher ground, because if people are affected this early, then it's only going to get worse when the rainy season proper sets in. But what we're also doing, for example, is once we've moved people away, we've closed down latrines in those areas where they were formerly located so as to avoid water contamination. So that's the key thing that we're doing. Of course, people need more aid overall, and they're receiving nutritional care now and medical care now, but we'll need more of that as more people continue to arrive.
What are the refugees telling you about their journey from South Sudan?
People report having to walk a long time. They're walking bare feet. People are arriving famished as well as frightened. There's an overwhelming majority of people who are basically women and children. So many of the women are saying that their men folk have not been able to flee. Some of them have been killed and others have been recruited into the conflict. This is not just a displacement crisis, but also a hunger crisis. And there's really a shortage of food inside South Sudan.
The number of the refugees arriving in Ethiopia really seems large. And what is your capacity to handle this influx?
Well, we have been on the ground, and we've really stepping up our assistance in recent days. We've flown in more tents, 4,000 tents on the way now, and we've already identified a new camp. So we certainly have the capacity to receive more people. We're gearing up the operation, and we're ready to receive this steady stream of people, but we do need more help from the international community.
That is Ariane Ramari, spokesperson for the UNHCR from Geneva. She spoke with reporter Nabil Biagio. Masked gunmen kidnapped the Jordanian ambassador to Libya today on the streets of Tripoli. Ambassador Fawaz al-Itan was taken after an exchange of gunfire that wounded his driver. Jordan's foreign minister confirmed the report and said negotiations are underway for the ambassador's release. They offered no other comment. Libya's interim government has been rocked by violence since the ouster and death of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Prime Minister Abdullahi al-Tini resigned resigned on Sunday following an attempt on his life. Earlier, kidnappers held his son hostage for 4 months before his release. Journalists and diplomats are frequent targets of militia groups that emerged in the 2011 fighting. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Gunmen have kidnapped an estimated 200 students from a school for girls in northeastern Nigeria. As fighting continues in South Sudan, the number of refugees pouring into neighboring Ethiopia continues to rise. And the World Health Organization says the death toll in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is at least 121. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The World Health Organization says the death toll in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is at least 121. Most of the deaths, 108, are in Guinea. Overall, health ministries in Guinea, Liberia, and other affected countries have reported about 200 confirmed or suspected cases of the virus. Since the West Africa outbreak began, more than half of the 951 people quarantined because of the suspected contact with the virus have been discharged. WHO spokesman Gregory Hart says conditions in Liberia have stabilized with only one new case reported in recent days. In Guinea, a few new cases have been reported. Hart says health officials in Guinea do not have the outbreak under control yet. Prosecutor Curry Nail has finished his cross-examination of South African runner Oscar Pistorius by telling the court that Pistorius meant to shoot and kill his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp. Today's court session was the fifth day that Nail and Pistorius sparred over details of last year's killing as the prosecution sought to counter the athlete's defense that he thought he was shooting at a nighttime intruder. Nell spent a large part of his questioning today focused on the bathroom where Steenkamp was shot, particularly on the location of a magazine rack at the time of the shooting. He asserted it was located next to the blood-stained toilet, while Pistorius said someone had placed it there afterwards. The athlete's defense team is continuing presenting its case to the court. Pistorius was the second of what they have said would be 14 to 17 witnesses they planned to call. If convicted, he faces 25 years to life in prison. Pistorius is known as the Blade Runner for his carbon fiber prosthetic legs. He has won many Paralympic Games medals and was the first double amputee to compete in the Olympics. A new law in Ghana requires oil and gas companies to make greater use of local products and services. From Accra, Joanna Manti takes a look at whether this will lead to more job creation and whether Ghanaian workers and companies have the skills to take advantage of the law.
The broad objective of the law, known as Petroleum Regulation on Local Content and Participation, is to create jobs and promote business development. It gives preference to local groups in the granting of licenses for petroleum activities. The law further gives Ghanaians the opportunity to own up to a 5% stake in any investment by an international company. Ghana discovered offshore oil deposits in 2007. And commercial production began in 2010. The country's Petroleum Commission is convinced the new law will help more oil revenue reach the people. The chief executive officer of the commission, Theo Eshiring, said local participation in the oil sector will be a big boost to Ghana's economy.
It's through participation that you develop the skills of the people, so that at the end of the day, when the oil wealth is gone, we would leave an economy with skilled people, with skilled businesses. So we've had fantastic response from a great number of the companies. We have sat with them to help them go through the procurement process, and I must say the support has been very good.
However, it remains unknown whether the law will create more jobs in offshore oil exploration and drilling. Local companies active in the oil sector mostly offer onshore services such as engineering, construction, security, and transport. Some of the local companies are small and poorly structured. If they try to compete for lucrative offshore contracts, they stand to face stiff competition from more experienced firms from abroad. Eshirin hopes a proposed enterprise development center set up in partnership with international oil companies will help local workers and businesses gain the skills that oil companies need.
Nobody wakes up from the beginning and becomes an Olympic gold medalist. You need to go through a development process. I know personally that most of the rig workers are basically a legacy of the work during the 70s and 80s between Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire. Definitely, these gentlemen are advancing age, and there's a need for us to get younger people to fill that gap. Currently, the Petroleum Commission is embarking on an exhaustive human resource mapping to identify the skills that are applicable, those that we have in Ghana, those that are not available in the country, and find out exactly what we need to do to be able to develop these competencies locally.
The executive director of Ghana's Oil and Gas Service Providers Association, Nwete Ajiman, describes the new law as the best thing ever to happen in the country's oil industry. He said its provisions can lead to winning situations for both international investors and local companies hoping to profit from Ghana's growing oil sector. Joanna Manti for VOA News, Accra.
And a military court in Sierra Leone has charged 13 soldiers and a captain with mutiny. The men were arrested 8 months ago for allegedly planning a protest during President Ernest Bai Koroma's scheduled visit to Makini, his hometown in the north. The president's visit was cancelled, but the reason had not been given. Local media had reported the soldiers were trying to kidnap the president and kill the Minister of Defense. The 14 men have been held without bail since their arrest. If they are found guilty, punishment ranges from demotion to death by a firing squad. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Media network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Gunmen have kidnapped an estimated 200 students from a school for girls in northeastern Nigeria. As fighting continues in South Sudan, the number of refugees pouring into neighboring Ethiopia continues to rise. And the World Health Organization says the death toll in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is at least 121. Coming up, music from Guinea. And in our feature segment, we focus on South Africa, Africa's only nuclear power. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yehiz.
Douglas, I understand that the anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing tops your sports report this evening.
That's right, Your Highness. Thank you. 1 year after the deadly Boston Marathon bombings, the northeastern U.S. city today pays solemn tribute to the victims of the attack at one of the world's premier sporting events. VOA's Victor Beatty reports church bells will toll at the precise time the first bomb exploded at the race finish line April 15, 2013, killing three people and wounding more than 250 others.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden joined state and local officials as well as bombing survivors at a ceremony at Boston's Heinz Convention Center. Mr. Biden is expected to deliver remarks in tribute to victims as well as survivors and first responders. There will also be a flag-raising ceremony and a moment of silence at the race's finish line. Two pressure cooker devices allegedly hidden in backpacks by two brothers of Chechen descent, 26-year-old Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his 20-year-old brother Johar, sent metal fragments through the crowd of bystanders. Several people lost limbs. Mark Forcaro lost his right leg from above the knee.
I woke up on the ground with the firefighter on me, putting a tourniquet on my leg.
He sustained other shrapnel wounds and could still lose his left leg. Another bombing survivor, Roseanne Sedoya, lost the bottom of her right leg in the bombing and says she wishes the tragedy had never happened.
I don't think anybody knows what they're capable of doing until you're forced to be in it. And, you know, I think most people would want to get back to normal. And I think that's what I want to do is, and I sound so cliche, but I just want to be normal. I want to be pre-April 15th.
The blast set off a multi-day manhunt that ended with Tamerlan Tsarnaev dead from a shootout with police and Johar being arrested in a Boston suburb. He is due to go on trial in November on 30 federal charges and will face the death penalty. He has pleaded not guilty to the charges. As for the Boston Marathon, a tradition that dates to 1897, it will be held Monday with an expanded field of about 36,000 runners, some 9,000 more than in 2013. Organizers have boosted security with cameras installed along the route and thousands of police and hundreds of National Guard troops set to be deployed in the area. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Still in athletics, the International Athletics Federation Council has approved the timetable for the 2015 World Championships in Beijing. The IAAF Council is meeting for the third time in its history in Dakar, Senegal, with IAAF President Lamine Diack taking the opportunity to say farewell to his fellow council members in his home city. The 2015 World Championships in Beijing will run from 22nd to 30th August. The council also approved entry standards for the 10,000-meter marathons, race walking, and combined events as follows. For men, the qualifying time for the 10,000 meters is 27 minutes, 0.45, and for 32 minutes for women. The marathon event qualifying time has been set at 2 hours and 18 minutes and 2 hours and 44 minutes for men and women, respectively. The council also approved the timetable for the 2015 IAAF World Cross Country Championships in Guiyang, China, that has set for March 28, 2015. And it's also set the date of 26th March for the 2016 edition of the IAAF World Half Marathon Championships in Cardiff, Great Britain.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Missing breaking news is something that you never have to worry about.
VOAAfrica.com.
It's always there on our website, VOAAfrica.com. First, fast, fair, and in-depth news is what you get.
Now to our weekly countdown to the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. It's just less than 2 months to the opening match in Brazil. And for an update, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Netline Africa's Segun on the dot at DMA. Hello, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas. Serious concerns remain about Brazil's readiness. There are doubts over whether stadiums will be finished in time, and it is highly unlikely that all promised infrastructure work will be completed. Organizers will also have to worry about the widespread street protests that are expected during the tournament. Demonstrators are already unhappy about corruption, poor public services, and the billions of dollars being spent to host the World Cup and the 2016 Olympics. Right now, three stadiums and several airports are not ready. Despite the delays, President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, said the 2014 World Cup will be the, quote, most successful of all time, unquote. Blatter made the promise to Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, according to Rousseff's office. Rousseff said she spoke with Blatter on the phone for 10 minutes and accepted his invitation to attend FIFA's 64th Congress in Sao Paulo on June 10th, 2 days before the kickoff of the World Cup in the city. Well, whatever happens, one country that will be looking forward to a successful World Cup is Cameroon. The indomitable Lions will be looking to recapture the good old days. Cameroon became the first African team to reach the World Cup quarterfinals at the 1990 tournament in Italy. The country has qualified for all but one World Cup since, only missing out on the 2006 edition in Germany. At the last World Cup in South Africa, Cameroon had a disappointing outing, losing to the Netherlands, Japan, and Denmark. But that is now history. In South Africa, we completely veered off target, Cameroon midfielder John McCone said. But I think we have a better team now with better organization, and the players are happy and united. Last month, the indomitable Lions were routed 5-1 by Portugal in their first warm-up match for the tournament. But Cameroon will try to regroup during a training camp in Austria from May 20th to 31st. The team will play two friendlies against Macedonia and Paraguay before putting the finishing touches to its preparations against Germany on June 1st. In Brazil, Cameroon will play Mexico on June 13th, then Croatia on June 18th, and Brazil on June 23rd. Another of Africa's five representatives in Brazil is Ghana. The Black Stars are also looking forward to a brilliant outing at the World Cup, despite being in a tough group. Football fans at home will have an opportunity to see the Black Stars in action before they fly out to begin preparations for the World Cup. According to the Ghana Football Association, a farewell game has been arranged for the Black Stars against home-based players in the domestic leagues on May 31st at the Accra Sports Stadium in the nation's capital. Players from the Premier League as well as Divisions 1 and 2 will be selected to form the local squad, which will take on Kwesi Appiah's side. The Black Stars will begin official preparations with a friendly match against Holland on May 25th before moving to their training camp in the United States. Ghana is grouped with three-time world champion Germany, Portugal, and the United States in the first phase of the 2014 World Cup. Apart from Cameroon and Ghana, Other teams that will fly the African flag in Brazil are Algeria, Ivory Coast, and Nigeria. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Now from Lagos, let's move straight to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Auma with some more sports news.
Libya is jointly with El Salvador, Kazakhstan, Moldova and Vietnam the most improved national teams in the world, while Liberia has slipped by the widest margins according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland. The Elephants of Ivory Coast are Africa's highest ranked team in 21st place. Egypt is 24th, Algeria 25th, Ghana 38th, Cape Verde Islands 42nd and African champions Nigeria 45th. Tunisia is 49th, Cameroon 50th, Guinea 51st, and Mali 59th. Meanwhile, hosts Mauritania pipped Mauritius 1-0 in the opening round of their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations preliminaries in Nouakchott over the weekend. Elsewhere, South Africa fought hard from a 2-0 deficit to hold their Zimbabwean visitors to a 2-2 draw in a women's football friendly in Soweto.
Thanks. That was Mark Auma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's all the time we have for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Mpuga. Now back to you, Yahias.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on the Voice of America. And in our feature segment, we focus on South Africa, the continent's only nuclear power. And next in Malawi, an anti-AIDS organization is working to teach youths living with HIV/AIDS how to cope with the infection. But first, some music. Here is Karfala Kante of Guinea with Badenya Bonya.
Musoko, mi manu
Kerfele Kante of Guinea with Badenya Bonya. South Africa is Africa's only nuclear power and the first nation to have voluntarily given up its nuclear weapons. The government then committed to being fully transparent about its nuclear activities, which include research and power generation. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Power looks at what South Africa can teach the continent about nuclear technology.
South Africa is Africa's economic powerhouse and home to its only working source of nuclear energy. The government estimates 3 million South Africans live without power, but the majority of the population has electricity, and the government plans more through nuclear energy. South African energy experts say they can lead the way for the continent.
South Africa has the requisite expertise to embark on further nuclear programs.
South Africa is the only sub-Saharan nation with a robust nuclear power and research system. Wolsey Barnard is with the Department of Energy.
South Africa is involved in nuclear research, nuclear power generation for the last 27 to 30 years. So it's nothing new to us. And currently, 5% of our electricity is generated by means of two generators that situate with Kuiberg Nuclear Power Station. And we also have some nuclear facilities which is used extensively for medical research purposes and also isotopes for medical purposes.
Physicist Kevin Kem says South Africa also has the unique experience of stepping back from the nuclear weapons brink. During the apartheid era, the nation developed six complete atomic weapons.
We became the first country ever to declare that we had nuclear weapons and to stop them. To build an effective nuclear weapon, you actually need an enrichment level of about 90% or more. For a nuclear reactor, you do not need to go anywhere near 20%. And a few years ago, we took the decision to downgrade it to 19.5%, very visibly to bring it under the safe level of 20. So the importance is, are you being safe and open with everybody in the business? Then it should be quite safe.
South African companies say they have the expertise and the desire to help develop nuclear technology. Construction industry executive Jabulile Tlako says nuclear energy is the only likely solution to South Africa's energy challenges. The company she represents, Marian Roberts, also builds power plants.
Nuclear energy is safe. It is reliable and it's affordable. It's a form of energy that is affordable and it's safe. And we have to go through that route because now the energy industry in South Africa is threatened.
As African cities grow and the continent's energy needs rise, South Africa says its nuclear knowledge may be the key to bringing the continent fully into the modern world. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Malawi, an anti-AIDS organization is working to teach youths living with HIV/AIDS how to cope with the infection. Under a new initiative, the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation has established teen clubs where youths learn how to deal with stigma and discrimination. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In the central district of Nchewu, most of the standard 6 students at Dombole Primary School were excited about their class in life skills. But Martha, who is HIV positive, did not enjoy it. She says she was feeling ashamed in class, more especially during life skills lessons. that she would dare to answer any question relating to HIV/AIDS because she feared her classmates would discover that she was HIV positive and start avoiding her. Martha says she did not want her friends at school to know about her status because she was worried about the stigma and the discrimination. Sometimes she would pretend to be sick when the lesson starts and leave the class. If it had been possible, she would have even dropped subjects. The 13-year-old Martha says she was tested positive last year, soon after the death of her single HIV-positive mother. Martha had always been sick until a health surveillance assistant asked her grandmother to take her to Nchewu District Hospital for voluntary HIV testing.
She
says when the doctor told her that she was HIV positive, she cried and asked her grandmother where she got it from, and her grandmother told her she got it from her late mother. She says she was devastated and thought that her future was doomed, having heard stories of people dying from AIDS. Statistics show that mother-to-child transmission account for approximately 5% of the new infection in Malawi, despite several interventions to prevent child infections. Martha was put on ARVs right away, and the medical doctor introduced her to a teen club at the hospital, a youth-friendly psychosocial program which provides safe haven for youth living with HIV. The initiative, the first of its kind in Malawi, was started in 2011 with funding from Elizabeth Grazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. A total of 140 children are currently part of the initiative, operated from Nchewu District Hospital, where they are counseled and tested, initiated on a 5-ARV treatment, and introduced to a support group. Evelyn Sodoka is a nursing and midwifery technician at the hospital who coordinates the teen club. She says its members within the age range of 12 to 20 gather every last Saturday of the month to learn ways to maintain a healthy living and self-confidence.
We build self-esteem to these kids on the lessons that we render to the children. Others, when they were coming, they were maybe desperate, thinking that maybe it's the end of our lives. But according to lessons that we give them at the teen club, they build self-esteem. They know that they can rely on themselves. They are able to do some other things that they were looking themselves down, that I cannot manage to do such a thing.
Nsodoka says an average of 60 to 70 members gather each Saturday to take part in various outdoor sports and receive health care when needed. It also gives an opportunity for the adolescents and caregivers to discuss the illness in a safe environment that's free of stigma and discrimination. Participation in the teen club has helped Martha make new friends and have given hope that she will live her dream of a prosperous future. She says she has realized that she's like any other person and has nothing to worry about because they are being told that life is lived once and are advised that if they will be worried, they will die of worries. She says she's now actively participating in her classes, which include life skills lessons, and has hopes of becoming a journalist specializing in healthcare. Martha's ambitions resonate well with the country director for the Elizabeth Grazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation, Nicole Bonham. She told VOA that the initiative is also used as a training ground for future HIV/AIDS activists.
And I hope that we can create ambassadors and people living with HIV who can speak about the issues articulately. And so we hope that some of these young people will become spokespersons, because there's not enough people living with HIV who can speak openly about living with the disease and really help inform programs and policies and the work we do.
Malawi has one of the world's highest infection rates. Statistics show that 10% of the population between the ages of 15 to 49 is HIV positive. That's nearly half of the numbers registered in Swaziland, which has the world's highest infection rate. A recent UNICEF study puts HIV prevalence rate in the adolescents in Malawi at 15%. The majority of them were born with the virus. Bono says her organization is considering abasing the initiative, which has never had any dropouts, to other five districts where HIV programs are being implemented. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly supports the Tunisian people and their progress toward a future of economic prosperity and democratic government. Since the January 2011 revolution, the United States has committed more than $400 million to support Tunisia's transition, focusing on technical and financial assistance to Tunisia's economy and private sector, support for security in the country and along its borders, and support for its civil society and democratic practices. In an effort to support private sector-led growth in Tunisia, the U.S. has declared its intent to provide another sovereign loan guarantee to Tunisia, enabling the government to raise approximately $500 million from international capital markets at favorable rates. As a means to promote trade and investment in Tunisia, the Bilateral Trade and Investment Framework Agreement Council will address at its next meeting in June issues of market access, entrepreneurship, information and communication technology sectors, and intellectual property. In 2012, the U.S. launched the Thomas Jefferson Scholarship Program. The $10 million initiative sends Tunisian undergraduate students for one academic year of undergraduate studies at U.S. universities and community colleges. The U.S. Congress recently approved an additional $10 million for the program, increasing the total number of students to 400. In an effort to promote democratic governance, the U.S. is providing nearly $50 million to strengthen participatory and inclusive political processes, build the capacity of civil society to stay connected to citizens through ongoing civic education, and promote freedom of expression. The U.S. will provide more than $6 million in additional elections assistance for the planned 2014 elections. The United States has provided more than $100 million since 2011 to help professionalize and improve the capabilities of the Tunisian armed services, and $30 million to help professionalize and improve the capabilities of Tunisian law enforcement and justice sectors. In addition, the U.S. has provided nearly $6 million in training for law enforcement agencies in 2012 and 2013 to combat international terrorists and terrorist organizations. These many initiatives demonstrate the depth and breadth of the partnership and friendship between the United States and Tunisia, as well as the shared commitment to supporting Tunisia's historic democratic transition and its economic growth and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.